Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Fighting Through Podcast 12. More coffee with Flight Sergeant Claude Reynolds. Great unpublished history. Flight Sergeant Claude Reynolds is 95 years old in 2017 and still going strong. And he's a resident of Market Town Wyndham in Norfolk, England. Claude had the unenviable role of being rear gunner in a Lancaster during the Second World War, so he's got plenty of stories to tell. This show is the second in the Claude Reynolds series, so if you missed episode 5, the first one, you might consider listening to that before you hear this one. Hello again. I'm Paul Cheel, son of Bill Cheel, whose World War II memoirs have been published in hardback by Pen and Sword in Fighting Through from Dunkirk to Hamburg. The aim of these podcasts is to give you the stories behind the story. You'll hear memoirs and memories of veterans connected to Dad's war in some way, and much more. For starters today, I want to say thank you so much to the many thousands of people who are listening from all over the world. My biggest audience is in the USA, followed by UK, Ireland, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and Sweden, and Germany. The list covers pretty much the entire world. I've got one person listening in each of Cambodia, Philippines, and Costa Rica. So if that's you, please drop me a line and say hello. If anyone has a photo of a relative who fought in World War II, drop me an email and we'll add their photo to a listener's gallery of honour I'm starting up. A special thanks to Abby, who wrote in recently. She listens to podcasts a lot whilst at work and was asking if Dad's book was going to be made into an audiobook. The answer is not right now, but I hope to do so in the future, along with an audiobook based on another memoir I've been given by veteran Wilf Shaw. But more about that another time. Abby, you've inspired me enormously and made me think about possibilities I'd almost discounted. So thank you once again. I'll get on with the show now. And for those who stay till the very end, there will be an exclusive preview of the next episode, together with the customary PS. You'll always know from now on that the podcast isn't over till you've heard the PS. And I always try to make the PS worth waiting for. Over to Claude. We're going to talk about some of Claude's flying action, right through to the fun he got up to in the Home Guard, and ending with what he did after the war, in his hometown of Wyndham, near Norwich, in Norfolk, England. There are quite a few funny stories too. I should warn listeners that there is some mild swearing in this show. Here goes, and I do hope you enjoy. When you joined then, did any of your pals join with you?
No.
They didn't, nobody else alongside
you? No, I went on my own.
How old were you when you joined up?
I don't know, 21, 2.
21, 2, yeah. How old are you now? 95?
I'm 94 at the minute, going on 94. No, right. I was born 1921.
Right. How old were your typical comrades on your flight crew?
Well, they varied. I don't know if you know or not, but all aircrew were volunteers. And they used to come up from other ranks. They used to re-muster from... There was one a policeman I knew. He was RAF police to aircrew.
Right.
And that's how a lot of them were. They joined the RAF or something, and then they re-mustered into aircrew later on.
When you joined your squadron, how did you get on the plane, or how did you join the crew that you joined? Did somebody just say to you, you're going to be on this plane?
After the initial RAF training,
yeah,
I then went on a gunnery course to Ireland.
Right, yeah.
We were cadets then, yeah. RAF cadets. Well, when we passed out, we were given a rank, sergeant then. We were then airmen. We got posted to our respective squadrons.
Yes.
Then. There, you met up with the individual people who were already pilots.
Right.
And you were assigned to that crew.
Ah, okay. Why would that particular crew have had a vacancy? Was it because they were just...
No, they were conversion offer. We were then going on to Wellington. But before that, they were pilots that had been probably trained in Canada.
Okay, so it was a freshly formed unit.
They were freshly formed.
Do you remember the name of your plane that you flew on? Did it have a name?
Oh, it didn't have a name. That was E. That was E-Easy.
Right, just E?
Yes, just a letter E, E-Easy.
All
right. We weren't like the Yanks, made all up. Funny names and that.
Because Dad's pal, Don Savage, that he was the rear gunner in a Lancaster, his plane, it was the Lily Mars, they called it.
Oh, yeah.
And it was LL871 something or other. That was its code number. He was in 514 Squadron at Water Beach in Cambridgeshire, so he wouldn't have had anything to do with you, would he?
No, I was in Lincolnshire.
You're in Lincolnshire, yeah. You enrolled in 1943. How soon do you reckon you were flying on your first mission?
Yeah, that must have been a good 6 months. I reckon I started flying on ops. I thought about somewhere around about June.
Yeah.
But I don't know which year.
No. Well, it was 1943, clearly, from this. So, from when you started your missions, how long? Because you did 30 missions, didn't you?
Yeah.
How long would those missions have been spread over? Would it have been over about 6 months or a year? Can you remember that?
They were spread over. I started in June and finished in December.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, there were times when you went one night, next night, and now night after night. But then you had the laurels.
Do you remember the name of your commander? Any of your commanders or officers? Obviously, Bomber Harris.
No, I can't.
Bomber Harris was the top man, wasn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, he was.
You never shook hands with him then?
No.
Never saluted him?
Well, the pilot was, his name was Barry.
That was his surname?
John Barry.
John Barry, oh, excellent.
Yeah.
I'll see if I can look him up.
The navigator's name was the same as mine. His name was Edward Reynolds. The wireless operator was an Australian. His name was Leonard Smart.
Do you know there are people listening to this podcast in Australia? Do you know how many people have listened to your first interview? 500.
Oh, look.
And it's only been up a week. You know, it's going to be thousands as the years go on, Clark. So it'll be nice if these families ultimately get in touch.
The barman's name was Perry. I can't remember his first name.
All right, well, surname's better than first name, so that's good. Who was that, sorry? What was he?
He was a bomb aimer.
A bomb aimer, right. What about the...
There was a mid-up gun. I can't remember his name, but we had three or four then.
Yeah. Did any of your comrades on board get shot up?
No.
No. What sort of condition was your plane typically in after a mission? Did they come back with shrapnel marks or flat marks and stuff?
No.
Generally in reasonable condition.
Yeah.
Unless they got into real trouble.
Yeah, the same as they took off, really.
Yeah. What were your feelings when you went out on a mission? Was it just a job to be done and you didn't focus on the fact that you might get blown up?
No. You don't think that, do you?
No.
You're driving a car today.
Yeah.
You know there's got to be a... half a dozen people killed on the road. That ain't got to be you, is it? That's got to be the other bugger next door.
That's a good analogy, that, Claude.
Well, that's it. That's how it is.
Yeah.
That ain't you. You used to look round the squad and say how many of them aren't coming back.
Yeah.
That never used to be you weren't coming back.
Do you know what the statistics were for Bomber Command as a whole? I'll tell you.
Yeah.
Out of 125,000 crew...
Yeah.
That flew, and that was all nationalities. In fact, that wasn't just Brits, it was Aussies,
no.
Canadians, I think there were some Americans, oh, Commonwealth pilots, Polish, French, a few French as well, all sorts. But anyway,
125,000 in all, of which 55,000 were killed.
Yeah.
I think it was another 8,000.
I reckon the ray gun was about 1 in 3.
Got killed?
Mm.
Gosh. Yeah, I think it was another 8,000 were prisoner of war. Something like that. So, yeah, the odds were quite seriously poor, weren't they?
Yeah.
But anyway, obviously they didn't tell you that because they might have put you off your aiming.
Well, I was all printed about one then.
Yeah. When, just turning to the raids now, how did they organise a raid in terms of number of planes and stuff? How many were in your... I mean, you said flotilla then.
Well, there was... Your squadron. I suppose you'd pick them up on the way. I suppose that could be anything, really.
Right.
Up to about 250, I suppose, aircraft. But they didn't all come in the same squadron, did they?
No.
Yet the same airfield.
Ah, so there could have been mixed squadrons and mixed
airfields. Well, yeah, they were, weren't they?
Right, okay. What was the biggest raid you can remember going on?
Well, I don't know what you mean when you say the biggest. What,
in terms of how many planes you were aware were
you
in
don't
the sky.
Know, that you don't see them, do you?
Right.
That's pitch dark.
It's pitch dark, okay.
You only see about 2, 3.
And did they
until
not...
you get over the target, then there's hundreds of them.
When you got back, did they never tell you where you'd been or what you'd been doing?
Well, you knew where you were going before you went.
Right.
You'd have briefings. You'd go in for briefing. The gunners would go in to see the gunnery officer, and he'd tell you all about the weather prospects, what they were like over there and over here, and what you were likely to come in contact with, yeah. Whether that was anywhere near fighter squadrons or anti-aircraft fire.
Yeah.
Sometimes searchlights and anti-aircraft fire. You'd come out there and you'd go into the main one. Because the pilots would have theirs, and the navigators would have theirs, and they're separate little bits.
Yeah.
The navigation officer would tell the navigators and the wireless people to take the radio people. And so, and then you'd come out and have a general, and when you went at the general one, you'd all go in together.
Right.
The crew would go in together, you'd be together. And you'd have a big map on the wall, and that would be a piece of tape, would be taped on it where you were going and right. The route you were taking.
Can you remember any of the names of any of the places you went to?
Well, Stuttgart, we went to Stuttgart, that was about the biggest. We went to a lot of little places in France. We done a lot in France.
You said you did some buzz bombs.
Yeah, on them bug bomb sites.
You said that's the V1, isn't it?
V1, V2.
Yeah.
And rocket sites in France.
Also known as doodle bugs.
That's it.
So you did quite a lot of raids on those places where they were located.
Yeah. But you had to do miles to get to Germany, didn't you? You had to go right down south of France and then across the bloody Alps and up that way.
Yes.
You never, if you could go direct over the North Sea.
Ah, right. You took a roundabout route.
Well, yeah.
Yes.
Otherwise, they'd pick you up on their radar, wouldn't they? Right. They'd know you were going, wouldn't they?
Yeah. Yes, yes.
Or they'd know where, at least I suppose they knew you were going, but at least they didn't know where you were going to.
Yes.
That's why you went all zigzag everywhere.
Ah, okay.
Sort of thing. They was on about their radar, which could pick you up, couldn't they?
Yeah, they'd pick you up on the radar.
They'd pick you up on the radar, wouldn't they?
All right.
If you were all going off over the measure about 500 bloody aircraft flying over the North Sea.
The English are coming very quickly. I don't know if that was French or German, actually. I understand what you were bombing was the underground V1 storage depots.
That's it.
I think it was quite successful, wasn't it, that campaign, coupled with the Brits shooting the things down in the air as well. I think altogether the...
Well, we stopped a lot going out of London, I suppose, but they had a hell of a job, didn't they?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's all right. The only one I remember is that place called, and I spelled H-E-I-L, Heilbronn, or Heilbronn. Now, I don't know whether that was in France or whether that was in... That must have been German.
Heilbronn sounds German, yeah.
Heilbronn. That was the last one I done. That was December.
Bomber Command has undergone some criticism over the years, hasn't it?
Well, yeah, they had a lot of people, right? We were murderers and one thing and another.
Yeah.
But the other thing is, we're forgotten.
Yeah.
We're completely forgotten. I don't care what anybody say. When you talk about to anybody about the RAF, they immediately think of the Battle of Britain.
Yes.
And the fighter boys.
Yeah.
That's all the fighter pilots.
They don't think of the 55,000.
They don't think nothing about nothing about the bomber crews. Yeah. Well, they wouldn't, would they?
I think in recent years there's been more attempts at recognition because they've put a monument up in London, haven't they?
I put one of them up, yeah.
To Bomber Command. And have you been to see it?
No.
I saw it a couple of years back and it is a magnificent monument. And I think in some ways it goes a long way to setting the record straight. So, yeah, but your view of the bombing role, I think to most people who were realistic about it, it was an absolute necessity, wasn't it?
Well, I think that was a big step in winning the war, weren't it?
Yeah, yeah.
That's how I look at it.
When you look
I done my bit.
Yeah.
Whatever happened.
Yeah. It's quite amazing, really.
I mean, there's a lot of us, weren't there?
Yes, yeah. Unbelievable, 125,000.
That's right. But that was spread over. You've got to spread that 125,000 over how many years? 6 years. I don't know how we compare with the army. I don't know.
Well, Dad served through the entire period, from beginning to end. But he was a volunteer, funnily enough. He was in the Territorial Army before war broke out.
That's it.
And then, so when war was declared, of course, all the Territorials were the first to be called up.
Yeah, well, they were here. They were that's one of the reasons why I joined up. You walked about on your own, weren't you? They'd all gone.
Yeah.
They'd volunteered for the Territorials. Well, Royal Norfolks, they all joined the Royal Norfolk, and the Royal Norfolks all got captured by Singapore. Well, they were all gone, weren't they, then?
Yeah.
There weren't nobody but only salvages and the scattering RAF. That's the, and you were out of place. If you walked about fit, like I was in reserved occupation for being out in the food chain.
Yeah.
You see? You were out of bloody place. They'd look at you as though you shouldn't be there.
Oh, dear.
So I thought, well, I had enough of this bugger. I went up there and volunteered to go. But I couldn't, they wouldn't take me.
Yeah.
Until they decided they want more men, I suppose. And then they put these circles up. You two can fly with the RAF.
Yeah.
Men in reserved occupations. I said, look and see the old circle of the hill. And I went up and volunteered and was accepted, and that was it.
Yeah. Good for you, Claude. Can you tell me about your most memorable experience, if you've got one?
I think the first five and the last five
missions
were the heaviest on your mind.
Yeah.
The first five, because you didn't know what the hell you were going into.
Yeah.
Especially being in the rear turret, I only saw what we'd been through then. I couldn't see what the hell was in front. Yeah. Today.
It's like facing the back on a train.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's it. I was going backwards.
I suppose
I thought you used to sit there and think, well, how the hell do we get through that lot?
How did you get through it?
How did you get through it?
Yeah, yeah. I guess it didn't give you a chance to be scared at what you could see coming towards you.
That's right. Well, then, so you didn't know what to expect from these few raids. But once you've done five, you were used to it. You were an old hand then, of thing.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
So that was, you just go out and jump in the aircraft and off you go, sort of thing.
Yeah.
And the last five, the law of averages was getting against you.
So you're beginning to think,
I said, that's my turn next.
Well, do you know, Dad's pal Don, he was killed on mission number 28. So they were very close to the end, weren't they? Would they have had one more mission left? Because I know you said you did 30 because you did an extra one. But how unlucky was that?
I done one extra. I done 30. You should have done 20. He should have done 29. Because the first one, the pilot went on his own with another crew.
Yes.
With a crew that had done, say, 20 ops.
Yeah.
He'd go there to see what was going on and just to acclimatise him to the whatever it was he'd got to come, sort of thing.
Yeah.
And they all did that. They all went on their own, the pilot, just the pilot.
Yes.
Went with another full crew as a passenger.
Okay.
See?
Yes.
But that counted for the rest of the crew. So you only actually done 29.
Right.
But I done an extra one because the Ray Gunner went sick.
Yes.
And the bloody pilot volunteered me to go.
Ah, did he? That was kind of him.
Yeah. You're on. And I said, what were you on? I don't know. I said, how come? He said, because he said, they want another Ray Gunner. And I said, you'd go.
You'd have been bloody furious if you got killed on that mission, wouldn't you? Yeah, you wouldn't have let them do that to you again.
So that's what happened. So I did my full whack. I did 30. Dead on.
Did you, what medals did you get, Claude? I know you got some medals.
I got three. You got the Defence Medal. France and Germany.
Yeah.
With another one. I don't know, I can't tell you now. But then they issued a bar, didn't they?
Right.
They issued a class, they called it, last year.
Right.
To the crews who were on the Arctic convoys.
Right.
The Navy.
Yeah.
The merchant, I know they had merchant ones over there with the naval one. They had a medal. Well, they said, because they had a medal, the bomber crew should have a class.
Right.
And they issued it with a little clasp.
Yes.
And that just a little thing you stick on your toe.
Yes, yeah.
I think if you had a matchstick and halved it, I think that'd be about the size of it.
Not over generous then. Well, you know, Dad's cap... There were short of things in the war. I know Dad's cap badge was a First World War issue cap badge. His greenhouse cap badge. I remember somebody saying to me, That's not a Second World War cap badge. I said it is. Well, I said it was definitely the one that Dad had. And then we realised in the end that that was common practice. They used up the supplies before they started using...
Hell, they got nothing, had they, when they started?
No. I know Dad was training with a wooden rifle at one point.
I had a wooden broom handle.
Did you?
I had joined the Home Guard or something. You had, even if you were in reserve occupation, you had to join something.
Right.
So I joined the Home Guard, you see.
This was
before I volunteered for the RAF.
Right.
Well, I was in the Home Guard. Well, you never know which bloody tricks you used to get up to there. I was guarding bloody flats. That's the first time I got wrong. I didn't get put on a charge or nothing, but I got reprimanded.
Right.
First time I got reprimanded. Well, the sat. I'd only been in it. I was only there a fortnight, and I was put on guard these flats at night.
Right.
And he said, "Now, if you see a car coming down there with headlights,
don't let them see your broom."
No, he said, "That'll be the orderly officer."
Right. Yes.
Come to check up, you see. He said, "Now all you do is you just stand there, salute him, let him go back. He'll do what he got to do, and then come back." Yeah, okay, all right. He said, "But for Christ's sake," he said, "stand rotation and salute him." See, so wait. Well, I stood there, and of course he would have come when I was on, wouldn't he? Wait, come the thing with these, and the headlights then had these masks on, didn't it?
Yes.
Just slots. So he, why come this officer? And so I jumped to retention and saluted him and let him walk past, and he'd gone about 5-6 steps past and come back.
Right.
And he said, "Are you on guard?" I said, "Yeah, with this broomstick."
Oh,
So he said, why did you let me through? Well, I said, you're an officer. I had to salute you and let you go through.
Yeah.
He said, you didn't challenge me at all, did you? I said, no, I didn't challenge nobody. He said, I could have been a German.
Yes, yeah.
See? He said, you should have said, halt, who goes there? I said, well... And I thought, I had a good mind to say, well, the sergeant never told me that. Because I didn't. And yeah, and I got put on charge of insubordination.
Did you?
The bloody officer.
Oh, honestly, as if they haven't got enough to do, eh?
Yeah.
Oh, crikey. That smacks of, like, the old Home Guard.
Don't it?
Dad's Army, yeah.
Yeah. That wasn't much more than that, really, when we first joined it. They got nothing, had they?
Yeah.
Well, then I had to join something. No, we had railway, the rails, the metal, what the bloody train went on, and they bent them, so they were, then they drilled holes in the road. I remember, it was just the other side of Attleborough, and we had to carry these head things, these railway tracks, and stick them in these holes in the ground,
right.
And to stop tanks, I reckon, if we got invaded, all that sort of thing. Then they put me on an old Lewis gun, an old Pan Lewis gun. You it was two of you. I was the loader, and my brother he was actually on the gun. And we used to go out of our lay in Queen Square, and he'd be laying there, and I used to keep putting these bloody pans on and off this gun.
And that this was a real gun.
Take an empty one off, right. And put a full one on.
So it wasn't a vacuum cleaner.
So there wasn't no bloody ammunition in these pans, mind.
There weren't any vacuum cleaners.
You never had ammunition in them. So if we got invited, I know I'd throw at them, I suppose.
If there was an enemy, they wouldn't have known, would they? So you'd have had to call it. So that's when this officer castigated you about the...
No, that was in London when I was on these flats.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah. They had a queer way of issuing uniforms as well. They used to chuck anything at you, a pair of boots and that, didn't matter whether it's such. You changed them later.
Okay, yes.
You got a pair of boots.
So it didn't matter if it was the right size or not?
No, that didn't mean you had to go and change it.
I'm just looking through this sheet. It doesn't really mean a lot to me, but it...
No, I don't.
It. You finished...
There's some promotions on there, AG, right. And then Sergeant, yes. And WO, and...
Yes, it says here, 31st of December, 45, Warrant Officer, Character VG. So you obviously got very good for character. Looks like you got VG several times. Yeah, there's not much else on here of any significance.
No, there isn't. There's a lot of rubbish on there.
Yeah. What was it like after the war when you first went home?
Well, I got demobbed 1947.
Right. After you'd finished your last flight, and because that was probably a couple of years, wasn't it, before you actually demobbed, what were you doing in that period when you weren't flying?
Ah. Now, previous to that, they were going home on indefinite leave.
Right.
And they were recalling them as they wanted them.
Right.
If they wanted them. But by the time I got that far, they'd altered it. Instead of letting us go home on leave.
Yes.
And then I had to go back and remuster to a ground staff job.
Oh, okay, yes. I remember now because you were parachutes.
I remastered the parachutes and dinghies.
Yeah, I remember that from last
time. That's it.
Yeah, okay. So when you finally went home in 1947, what, you went back to farming, did you?
No. No. That was a very bad winter, and I couldn't get a job until the following March. I got demobbed in December and couldn't get a job until March.
Crikey.
And the job I got was, you know where the Wyndham Abbey is?
Yes.
Where the Dereham railway line go over it,
right.
Over the road. There was a crossing hut there. I got a job there, 2 or 10.
Right.
On that crossing.
Railway crossing.
On that railway crossing.
Oh, right.
And then from there, I went back up to Wyndham Station.
Yeah.
As a porter.
Right.
And then they made me lamp boy. I had to go climb up them bloody signal posts on there and stick a paraffin lamp in them.
So you had to, put paraffin lights up.
Yeah, a lot of people don't believe that.
Do you know, it's funny because you tend to think of paraffin lamps or oil lamps being of a bygone day, but
hell, we used to have dozens of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
You used to have a lamp room. There was a lamp room on Wyndham Station. You had to take them in. You had to go out and take a load of lamps with you.
Yeah.
To each one, to each signal post. Every week, this was. They'd last a week.
Interestingly, they used to use the same type of lamp or technology on roadworks, didn't they? For many years.
You used to climb up the ladder, up the signal, up them. Iron ladders, what you see on sort of signals, and put one lamp in and take the old one out.
What did you light them with? A match or did you have a spill?
You lit them in the lamp room before you took them out.
Oh, okay, right.
And you carried them out a load.
Yeah.
And then you'd have to bring them all out of the lamp room and clean them.
Right.
And prepare them ready for the next week.
The next week.
But there always used to be one going out somewhere. You'd have to go during the day. You'd have there's such and such a signal gone out. You'd have tracks around there and down the track and
swap it over
for a fresh one. Yeah.
So what did you do after you did that job?
There was a signalman up at Wyndham South. The name Jackson, Fred Jackson, and. He knew me, and of course, and he said, I tell you what, he said, you're coming off that bloody job. I said, well, what do you mean, coming off it? He said, you're too good for that bugger. He said, you've got to come in this box.
Right.
I said, I can't do that bugger. There's about 43 bloody levers in that box. I said, hell, I said, I can't do that.
Yeah.
He said, yes, you bloody can. He said, they start a course up Norwich Thorpe Station to learn signalling. He said, now, you do what I tell you. He said, and I'll get you in. I said, right. And I said, well, I have a go at it.
Yeah.
So he said, right. He said, well, what we do, he said, you'll put a note, he said, on old Allerton's. Allerton was the station master.
Right.
He said, you'll put a note on old Allerton's desk, he said.
Yeah.
You don't want to see it. God, was he straight, he was sorry. And anyway, he said, you'll put a note on his desk. I said, don't bloody well not going in there. He said, you put a note on the wind, but they'll bugger in there. He said,
yes.
And he's down at Bell, he has to read it. He said, now if you address it to Norwich Thorpe Station, And then he said, you put in this letter. He told me how to word this bloody letter. So I word this letter to the Norwich Thorpe Station, this new class they started up.
Yes.
Could I would like to volunteer to.
Yeah.
So he put it on Arnold Allison and says, well, man, he went bloody mad. He came in there, he said, Reynolds, come here! He said, what made you think? He said, they got one tune to signal box. Well, I said, I don't know. I said, there's several of them in there.
He said,
they don't want you in there. He said, I'm not sending that up, he said. So he said, how'd you get on? So I told Fred, I said, not very well. I said, I reckon they didn't want me in there. He tore the bloody thing up. He said, he can't do that. Well, I said, hey, that's what he done. But he said, you can't write direct to them up Thorpe. He said, that I've got to go through the station master.
Right.
He said, now, if you put us through the stage pass, he's duty bound to send it up there, yes, if you address it to them.
Yes.
That's the procedure.
Right.
So I said, right. He said, well, write another bugger. Another one. So he called me in again. I sent that letter up, he said. They said, you don't hear no more about that. He said, go back to your duty. So, right.
Did you not say to him, do you realise I used to be rear gunner in a Lancaster? I'll have your
guts. He's already done that when I applied for the job. Yeah. So anyway. All right. So anyway, they accepted me up Nari.
They did? Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
That's
good. So I went up there, and that lasted, I think that course was about 6 weeks up there. I learned the signal job.
Yeah.
In the signal box. And I got posted straight away at Kettringham. They had a little signal box at Kettringham.
Right.
And all there was a signal box, and that was mainly shorten the distance from one section to another.
Yes.
Because that was too far from Wyndham and Norwich then that day. Because they were all manual then, weren't
yes.
they?
Oh, yes.
Right. Well, they had a signal box there, the side of the Lowen, and all there was three cottages on the side of the Lowen, the opposite side, where the chaps lived who worked on the Lowen. And I was up this signal box, and all I had there was a crossover. I could cross trains from one Lowen to the other.
Yeah.
I never had no sidings or nothing.
Right.
There was nothing really, so straight lines through with a line connecting the two roads up.
How often did you have to change a signal?
Well, every time a bloody train came.
How many times a day was that then?
Well, how many trains went from Norwich to London on this line? Wyndham, Kettringham,
right.
Heatherset, Norwich.
Are you asking me?
I don't know, a hell of a lot, wasn't
it? But it was a lot, was it? That's what I really meant, was it?
Oh, blast, yes, on a Saturday morning, they one behind the other queued up.
Oh, right, okay, so it kept you busy then.
You were busy.
You didn't have time to read a comic.
You had to read a bloody rule book. You had anything to read. You weren't allowed a radio or nothing in there. So anyway.
And did you work for the...
And then back to Attleborough.
Did you work for the railways the rest of your life then? Or
I took out early retirement at 62.
Oh, right.
Sheila got fed up with the bloody shift work, so I got fed up with going on shifts. And that was 2 to 10, 10 to 2 and a night shift.
Yes.
Every 3 weeks. And so I put in that early retirement at 62.
Did you get a medal after that?
No, I never got a bloody medal, never got nothing.
Didn't get a watch or anything?
No. I paid it at a pension fund. They paid me out in lump sum.
Right.
Rather than pay a pension.
Okay.
I got out, I don't think there was a lot in it, about 400 quid, I think, but that was a lot then.
Yes, yeah.
But they took half the bugger back.
Did they?
Yeah. They took the difference between what I should have paid had I been in the... Because I opted out of the National Health Service, I think.
Right.
There was a lot of complications during this business. I know. I opted out of that here of the Railway Pension Fund.
Yes.
Or something like that. And the Railway Pension Fund paid me out in this money. Now, the government took back what I would have paid had I paid it the National Health.
Right.
And they took half.
Oh, that's a lot.
So I got a couple of hundred, I think.
Jeepers.
And that was all my pension gone.
Did you take advice on whether or not they'd been straight with you?
No, there wasn't nobody you could get advice off that day, them time to day as well. There was the union, but the railway union were never much cop.
Claude, I'd like to just finish now and say thank you so much for your time. And thanks so much for doing your duty for God, Queen and Country during the war. And I personally feel a debt of gratitude towards you, and I'm sure everybody listening to this podcast will feel the same. So thank you so much, and thanks for sharing your memories with me. That's been
You ain't got nothing in there, but when I done that garden, have you?
When he did the garden? what, my garden?
Yeah.
No, I haven't. For the record, I know Claude because he's been doing, he's in my garden for a while. He used to mow the lawn for me.
Well, I'll nip in there before Claude tells you more than you need to know about all the weeds in my garden. Thank you so much, Claude, for sharing your memories with such good humour. It's interesting because I don't think I've come across a single memoir yet that didn't contain a good dose of humour in it. And it makes me believe that this was one way these men and women coped with the often traumatic and unpleasant experiences they'd had. Thanks again, Claude, for your really insightful answers to some of my questions and for your service to King and Country. I don't know if anyone spotted my deliberate mistake during that podcast, but there are some things that are just too difficult to change once they're recorded. You know, I was in tears when I listened to Claude's story about the broom handle, and at a personal level, I found it all to be quite an immersive history lesson. I hope you did too. Next episode. Another Lancaster bomber adventure. I had a pre-war pal called Don Savage. He was only 18 and a grand lad who'd been camping with me at Crediton near Devon in 1939. We had been good friends. When he left the grammar school, he joined the RAF, becoming an air gunner on Lancasters. When he went on one of the bombing raids, he was posted missing, never to return. Bill Cheel, 1994. From this small snippet of information in Dad's book, more and more pieces of the jigsaw have been uncovered and can now be shared in this podcast. The plane was shot down over Holland on the last tour of duty for its crew, some of whom have been tracked down by relatives or surviving comrades. Learn about Don's and others' sad demise. The tragic yet heartwarming story of the brave Australian, Canadian and British crew of RAF Lancaster LL-678, fondly known as the Lily Mars. It doesn't get much better than this. Look out for episode 13, The Last Flight of Lancaster Lily Mars. If you want to comment on or share what you've heard so far, you can do so via the fightingthroughpodcast.co.uk website. You'll find all the links there. In particular, if you've enjoyed listening and you think other people would enjoy this, please rate the series on iTunes or your usual service provider, as doing this does help raise the profile of the podcast in the search engines. See the website for easy feedback links. And I'll always be delighted to hear from you on anything. For now, thank you so much for listening. Oh, the PS. I mentioned at the end of the interview that I first got to know Claude when he was younger and used to do a bit of light gardening for me. I've got to share this anecdote with you because it's about my mum Anne and Claude, who were both in their 80s at the time. Now, I need to tell you that Mum has a condition called macular degeneration, which rather badly affects her eyesight. Just one of my inspirations for doing this podcast, because it means she can listen even if she can't read. Anyway, Mum was staying with me for a few days and Claude was outside in the garden. Knowing who Claude was, my mum courteously asked, should I go outside and say hello to Claude? I rather mischievously replied, why, do you fancy him? Fancy him, asks my mum. I can't even see him. Listeners, I can assure you that I just chatted through this anecdote with Mum to see that she was happy that I put it up, because I didn't want it to seem inappropriate. But she's more than happy with it. She laughed at it again, and I can assure you that she's the one who's laughed the loudest at that little anecdote. So I hope you can share the humour as well. This was episode 12, Another Coffee with Flight Sergeant Claude Reynolds. I'm Paul Cheel saying bye-bye now.